from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the 2016 presidential election will be the first in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And this November, many voters will go to the polls with new restrictions in place. Though federal courts recently struck down laws in North Carolina, Wisconsin, and Texas that required certain forms of ID or reduced early voting times, the story is far from over. We talk with Ari Berman, senior contributing writer to The Nation, about the latest concerns over access to the polls in this high-stakes presidential election. Join us after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Though federal courts this year have struck down several restrictive voter ID laws and registration requirements, voting will still be harder to do in more than a dozen states, which will have new restrictions in place this November. With less than 50 days until the election, we take stock of the reforms, some in battleground states, and also look at the effect on the electorate of these attempts to restrict voting access. Joining us is Ari Berman, senior contributing writer to The Nation and author of the book Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Welcome to Forum, Ari Berman.
Hi, Mina. Good morning.
Thanks for being here. I want to start by talking about Texas with you. Not only was there recent news this week about Texas's attempts to get around a court order on its restrictive voter ID law, but also I feel like what's happening there illuminates the current struggle for access to voting. So could you first remind us what Texas's law is, what happened this summer in the courts, and what's happening now?
Yeah, so Texas passed one of the strictest voter ID laws in the country. Under the law, you can vote with a gun permit, for example, but not a student ID. The law was initially blocked in 2012 under the Voting Rights Act. Then the Supreme Court overturned a key part of the Voting Rights Act, ruling that those states with the longest histories of discrimination, including Texas, no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. There was another trial. Texas's voter ID law was again blocked by the district court. It went to the appeals court. The appeals court again invalidated the law, but what they said was that the law could remain in place but needed to be softened, meaning you didn't have to show strict forms of government-issued ID anymore to be able to vote. You could show less restrictive forms of ID, like a voter registration card or a bank statement or a utility bill, for example. The problem was even after the Fifth Circuit ruled this, the state of Texas didn't comply with the law. They basically tried to make it seem like you still needed strict forms of government-issued ID. So then they went back to court, and the court ruled yet again that Texas needs to comply with the law. So this is an extraordinary situation where a restrictive voting law has been struck down multiple times, and Texas is only complying with the court order, kicking and screaming.
Right. And so basically, one of the things that they're doing is making it sound like an affidavit that folks can sign if they don't have the forms of ID that Texas requires, that if they sign this affidavit, they could be criminally investigated?
Yeah, so the affidavit provision is really supposed to be a fallback for people that don't have strict forms of government-issued ID. And it's worth noting that the federal courts have found that 600,000 registered voters in Texas don't have strict forms of government-issued ID. That's about 5% of the electorate, and Black and Hispanic voters are 2 to 3 times more likely than white voters not to possess these documents. So it's a lot of people we're talking about. It's not just a few people here and there. It's hundreds of thousands of voters that could be affected. And what the court says, if you can't obtain this ID, if for some reason you don't drive, you don't have a driver's license, you couldn't find your birth certificate, you never had a birth certificate, so you couldn't get underlying documents that you needed to prove your identification, then you can still vote by signing an affidavit and saying that you're going to show another form of less restrictive ID, like your voter registration card, for example, which you needed in previous Texas elections. The state of Texas is spinning that, basically saying, if anyone gives us false information on this affidavit, we are going to prosecute them. And what they're trying to do is make voting seem like a criminal act. And they're especially trying to scare, in my view, Latino voters away from the political process, who are already afraid given the political climate in this country, given the things Donald Trump has said, given the government of Texas, from trying to participate. And Texas is saying further to them, if you try to vote, you could become a criminal.
And, you know, you mentioned some of the education materials and even tweeted out, I think, a couple of weeks ago, an image of, you know, Texas voting education materials that basically still said you need these forms of ID, these sort of seven more restrictive forms of ID, and not really mentioning the idea that you could use, you know, other forms.
So I was in San Antonio, Texas last week reporting a story, a different story with regards to Texas and voting rights, which will be out soon. And I noticed that in the Bexar County Board of Elections in San Antonio, they had a big poster up that said photo ID required when photo ID is no longer required. So I asked them, why is this poster still up? And they said, well, we've been busy with other stuff preparing for the election. I said, okay, but you guys have the correct information on your website that says that photo ID is no longer required. And they said, yeah, we have that information. It's behind the desk. And I said, well, why don't you just put it up as a big poster? And they said, well, we haven't got around to doing it yet. I mean, so this is an example of, I don't think the county's trying to suppress voters, but whether it's bureaucratic inertia or whatever, people are walking into the elections office in the seventh biggest city in America, one of the biggest counties in Texas, and they're getting inaccurate information. It makes you wonder what's going on in the counties that really love voter ID, that really may want to suppress the vote. What kind of information are they giving out? And so I think the confusion here is a big part of the suppression, that people are just so confused, they may not show up even if they can actually vote.
And we're talking about all of these things in part because, you know, it made big news that that voting rights advocates, right, won significant victories in the courts this summer. But it sounds like you're saying this really isn't a time to be able to sit back and let this election unfold based on the idea that courts have struck down restrictions.
Well, there's a bunch of different things that have happened. So in 14 states, there are new voting restrictions in place in very important swing states like Ohio and Wisconsin, for example. In other states, voting restrictions have been struck down, like in North Carolina, which is very big news, and I'm sure we'll talk more about this. In other states, the law has been softened, but not altogether eliminated, like in Texas. And I'm concerned that that's going to lead to a lot of confusion because most people are not election junkies. And so they don't follow the back and forth of this stuff. They don't follow, well, there was a voter ID law, and then it was struck down, and then it was reinstated, and now it's still there, but it's been modified. I mean, this is so complicated for people. And I think there is evidence from the 2014 election. There was a Rice University study that showed that in one congressional district in Texas, 12% of voters did not show up because they thought that they didn't have the right forms of ID. Now, it turned out that only about 2% of voters didn't have the right forms of ID. But the fact that people just didn't believe they would have the right ID led many to stay home. And I'm confused that a similar dynamic could happen in 2016.
Right. And you mentioned the 14 states that will have new voting restrictions. So, for example, New Hampshire, Virginia, and Wisconsin have new voter ID laws. And then there are early voting cutbacks, basically reduced times for early voting or reduced opportunities during early voting to register and vote on the same day. These are occurring in Arizona and Ohio. Could you talk a little bit about, and you mentioned North Carolina, and I'd like you to talk about North Carolina because I think what they tried to do to restrict voter access says a lot about the effect of cutting back on early voting times as well as the types of restrictions related to voter ID.
Yeah, so what happened is a month after the Supreme Court undercut a key part of the Voting Rights Act, North Carolina passed a sweeping rewrite of their election laws. They didn't just require strict voter ID. As you mentioned, they cut back on early voting. They eliminated same-day voter registration during the early voting process. They eliminated pre-registration for 16 and 17-year-olds, which was taught in high schools. All of these reforms that had benefited North Carolina, that had led it to go from 37th in voter turnout in 2000 to 11th in voter turnout by 2012, were eliminated. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals just struck down all of these measures. They said in a remarkable opinion that these measures targeted black voters with, quote, almost surgical precision. And they specifically talked about cutting early voting. North Carolina cut a week of early voting. According to the data, early voting is very popular in North Carolina. About half of voters in North Carolina voted early, but 70% of African Americans in North Carolina voted early. So it was particularly beneficial for the black community because there tend to be long lines often on election day in black neighborhoods, which may have fewer poll workers, fewer voting machines. So things like early voting make voting a lot more convenient, particularly for those groups that have historically been marginalized. So what Some of the evidence they cited to cut back on early voting was the fact that North Carolina eliminated early voting on the Sunday before the election, on Sundays in general before the election. And the court asked North Carolina, why did you eliminate voting on Sunday? And the state said, well, it was used in some counties more than others. And they said, well, which counties was it used more in? And North Carolina said it was used more in counties with large black populations that tended to vote Democrat. And the court said that North Carolina just admitted that they reduced early voting because it had been used more by people of a certain race and of a certain party. And they said that that evidence amounted to as close of a smoking gun as you're likely to see in modern times. And one last thing about this was, even after the court told North Carolina to restore early voting, counties across North Carolina still tried to cut early voting, which just goes to show you that even after these court decisions come down restoring voting rights, there are still states like North Carolina that are trying to resist them.
And you mentioned the opinion a little bit earlier by the judges, and it was a really remarkable opinion because it, I don't know if it was explicit as much as it suggested not just a discriminatory effect, but that they intended to discriminate when they introduced those laws.
Absolutely. What the court said, what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals said, was that North Carolina looked at all of the measures that had led to increased black turnout. So one of the reasons why voter turnout increased in North Carolina and why black turnout in particular increased over white turnout in 2008 and in 2012 was that North Carolina adopted reforms like early voting, like same-day voter registration, like out-of-precinct voting that made it easier for people to cast ballots. And what the court said is that the state of North Carolina specifically targeted the very methods that African Americans used to increase their voter turnout, and that the legislature requested all of this data. They had it in front of them, and then they acted. So there was no way that they could have done this without knowing who was going to be most harmed by these restrictions. And that's why they found that this was intentionally discriminatory. They didn't need to find that it was intentionally discriminatory to strike down the law. They just had to show that it had an effect of discrimination. But the fact that they found it to be intentionally discriminatory is remarkable. That in the year 2016, we know that there are people in elected office that are still trying to intentionally discriminate against voters of color.
We're talking with Ari Berman. He's senior contributing writer to The Nation and author of the book Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We're talking about how the 2016 presidential election is the first in 50 years when citizens won't have the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And Ari Berman, North Carolina, as you've written, felt emboldened to do all this, particularly after the U.S. Supreme Court struck down a key provision of the Voting Rights Act in 2013. You touched on this earlier, but can you remind us exactly what the provision was and what it did?
So what the Supreme Court ruled was that those states with the longest history of discrimination, which applied mostly to the South but not exclusively, that they no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. They didn't strike down the requirement. They struck down the formula under which states like Texas and North Carolina were covered. And they basically said this was outdated and archaic. Chief Justice John Roberts said that the country had changed dramatically since 1965, but the Voting Rights Act had not. However, right after that decision, we saw that states like Texas and North Carolina rushed to implement new voting restrictions. Laws that were blocked as discriminatory, like Texas's voter ID law, were immediately put into effect. And states passed more sweeping voting restrictions, like in North Carolina. And if North Carolina previously had wanted to do something like cut early voting, like eliminate same-day voter registration, like require strict ID, they would have had to approve those changes with the Justice Department or the federal courts. And very likely, the law would have been blocked before it even took effect because there was evidence that this was discriminatory. Instead, North Carolina waited until this decision, and a month after they pounced, they introduced this sweeping rewrite of their election laws, and then it could only be blocked after lengthy litigation, after the law was put into effect, after people were already disenfranchised in the 2014 election. And so, yes, there have been victories for voting rights, but even the victories themselves have been so difficult. They've cost so much money. They've required so many hours of litigation. They've required so many battles to even get to the courts that even the victories kind of – they don't feel like defeats, but they don't feel like the overwhelming victories they should, given the amount of effort that has gone into this and given the fact that the Voting Rights Act remains weakened.
Well, it sounds like you're also saying that just the fact that there is that there has been a slew of new voting restrictions, that the fact that that word is out can have a deterring effect even if you're eligible to vote under them.
It can, because as I said earlier, most people don't follow the back and forth. They right. just hear, you can't vote, the law has changed, or you need this ID that we don't have, or the amount of days have been cut back. And what we saw in the 2014 election, when parts of the North Carolina law were put into effect, for example, they eliminated same-day voter registration, they eliminated out-of-precinct voting. We saw that people showed up and they wanted to register to vote before the election, and they couldn't anymore because the registration deadline had passed and there was no more same-day voter registration. Or they showed up at the precinct where they worked, and they couldn't vote there because it wasn't their correct precinct. What we see is that when people become comfortable with the law and the law changes, it has a very disruptive effect. And so when laws are rewritten and when they go back and forth to the courts, most people aren't following the back and forth. They only know what the law was when they last voted. And when it changes, that can be a big deterrent to people wanting to vote or having their votes counted.
But Ari Berman, supporters of new voting restrictions say they're really trying to get at voter fraud. Could you explain to us how prevalent voter fraud is?
Well, we've seen that voter fraud, particularly voter impersonation, which is a type of fraud you hear most often, is incredibly rare. That since the 2000 election, for example, according to one national study, there have been only 31 credible cases of voter impersonation out of more than a billion votes cast. And it was really interesting to see the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals wrestle with this in North Carolina, because one of the interesting things about the North Carolina law is it requires strict forms of ID for in-person voting, where fraud is incredibly rare, but it doesn't require ID for absentee voting, where fraud is more common. Still very rare, but more common. And the court said this: the North Carolina did this because there is data showing that Democratic voters, particularly African-American voters, are more likely to vote in person, whereas older voters who tend to skew more conservative, more Republican, are more likely to vote absentee. So under the guise of quote-unquote stopping voter fraud, the Fourth Circuit said that North Carolina's voter ID law was actually going to make fraud more likely because it was going to then allow Republicans to vote more than Democrats. So even laws that purport to stop voter fraud really have nothing to do with voter fraud when you take a closer look at them. And this whole notion of voter fraud, in my view, has been a completely manufactured crisis to try to build support for new voting restrictions that impact certain communities more than others.
Even if it's been manufactured, though, it's had a significant effect. The New York Times editorial board put out, a lengthy opinion about how the Washington Post ABC News poll found nearly half of registered American voters thought that voter fraud either occurs very often or somewhat, as opposed to what they said was the more correct answer, which was never, and only about 1% of folks said never.
Well, that's because you hear people like Donald Trump running around saying people are going to vote 10 times. And you hear the soundbite, but you don't hear the debunking, that the debunking requires more analysis, more argument, more facts. And that's what you don't hear. And we've seen Republicans across the country, whether it's in Wisconsin or North Carolina or on the national level with presidential candidates, run around screaming about voter fraud. And it's not surprising that people believe this. We see that half the country supports Trump to begin with. So, of course, they're going to support these kind of arguments. This has been really concerning to me, though, that there has been so much misinformation put out there and that this seems so difficult to debunk that, in fact, voter fraud is a very small problem in American elections, that it's actually very difficult to rig an election, particularly a very consequential election. And that, in fact, looking at the data from recent elections, far more people have been turned away from the polls by new voting restrictions than cases of voter fraud that were committed.
We talked earlier about, a couple of states jumping to pass some new restrictions on voting after the Supreme Court's decision in 2013. But really, you also write about how the real sort of onslaught of these types of laws occurred after President Obama was elected.
Yeah, so what happened was we began to see all of these new restrictions be introduced following the 2010 election when Republicans gained large majorities in states like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, or they had even larger majorities than they already had in places like Texas. And I think the reason why this occurred was it wasn't just the election of President Obama in 2008. It was the fact that there were 5 million new voters who cast ballots in 2008. And of those 5 million new voters, 2 million were African American, 2 million were Hispanic, and 600,000 were Asian American. And they voted 75% for President Obama. They were known as the Coalition of the Ascendant because they were the future of American politics. And this absolutely freaked out many Republicans who believe they were never going to be able to win these votes. So instead, they had to make it harder for these people to participate in the political process in the first place. And if you look at who is most impacted by these new voting restrictions, whether it's cutting back on the amount of time that people have to vote or making it harder to register to vote or requiring strict forms of ID to cast a ballot, it's more likely to be younger people. It's more likely to be people of color. It's more likely to be low-income individuals. These are all communities that tend to vote more for Democrats than Republicans.
Could you do you know the status of Governor Terry McAuliffe's plan to restore voting rights to ex-felons? You know, the Virginia governor, of course, he issued a sweeping order in April that restored rights to all ex-offenders who'd served their time or were on probation or parole. And he then that got overturned. But then he said that he would actually restore the rights of these felons on an individual basis since it got overturned because he wasn't allowed to do it en masse. Do you know where where they are with that?
Yes. Yeah, so Virginia is one of only a handful of states that prevents ex-felons from voting. So even after they've served their time, they still can't vote, which I think strikes lots of people as not very fair. And what happened was Governor McAuliffe in Virginia introduced an executive order saying he was going to give blanket restoration to about 200,000 ex-offenders. That was struck down by a 4-3 decision in the Virginia Supreme Court. And so McAuliffe has begun now to restore all of these people by hand. Now, the problem is that and that was just affirmed by the court that he has the power to do that. The problem is he says he's going to be able to restore 13,000 ex-offenders by individual signatures. But that's a small cry from the 200,000 people that he was going to be able to restore voting rights to through the executive order process. So he's going to be able to restore voting rights to some people, but it's going to be a small fraction of the larger population. And I think this is really unfortunate because these felon disenfranchisement laws have their roots in Jim Crow. This was one of many ways in which African Americans were prevented from voting at a time when, for example, you could get a felony if you were a black man and you looked at a white woman the wrong way. So lots of these laws have been repealed because they were discriminatory, but in Virginia, it remains in effect. It has a discriminatory impact. 1 in 5 African Americans in Virginia can't vote because of the state's felon disenfranchisement law. And I just don't think it makes a lot of sense that after you've served your time, you still can't vote.
We're talking with Ari Berman, senior contributing writer to The Nation. He's also the author of the book, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America, an expert on voting rights. He also makes the point that 2016 is the first presidential election in 50 years when citizens won't have the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. And even though federal courts recently struck down several anti-voter fraud laws, as they're called, as discriminatory, some states are finding ways to work around those orders. We'd like to invite you to join the conversation. Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org or post them on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Mina Kim. More with Ari Berman after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. This November, voters in more than a dozen states face new voting restrictions. We're talking with Ari Berman, senior contributing writer to The Nation, about those new restrictions and also about the fact that this presidential election is the first in 50 years when citizens won't have the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. Let's hear what our listeners have to say. Lynn tweets, and this is related to our earlier conversation about Texas, saying we haven't gotten around to fixing the sign is voter restriction. Really, it's voter tampering. Who will fix it? Her comment reminds me, Ari Berman, that there are a lot of sort of lower level, below the radar types of things that may or may not be intentionally designed, right, to limit voter access. But things like, I think in Missouri, I read that they're deciding to locate polling places now in buildings that are or that have their local police departments there, that, you know, just simply the act of cutting down the number of polling places because you're saying just administratively it's too tough to have the same number of polling places. Or if you've been called out on restricting early voting, you just make early voting sites fewer and far between. Are those types of things, I mean, would those have been the types of things under the VRA that would have been identified?
Absolutely. So we see under the Voting Rights Act of 1965 that there are lots of cases where after African Americans or other minority groups registered in large numbers, that white officials would shut down polling places in minority neighborhoods, or they would refuse to list candidates on the ballot, or they would redraw districts so that people wouldn't be able to elect candidates of their choice. There were lots of different ways that voting rights have been restricted even after the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And some of it is very obvious. Some of the times there's big statewide laws that are passed and there's a big deal about it. And sometimes it's things that are very under the radar. I'll give you an example. In Maricopa County, Arizona, home to Phoenix, you may remember that during the primary, they closed 70% of their polling places. And so they went from 200 polling places in 2012 to just 60 polling places for the primary in a county with 1.2 million registered voters. And there were five-hour lines in Maricopa County because of this. Now, the election administrators there said they were just trying to do it to save money. There wasn't any outright voter suppression, but the net effect was that people had to wait in five-hour lines. And Maricopa County was one of those places that previously had to approve their voting changes with the federal government because of a history of discrimination against Black and Latino and Native American and Asian American voters. And so the fact that they previously had to approve these changes meant that the federal government would have known about this far in advance and would have either blocked it or would have told people or would have worked out some sort of compromise. Instead, people showed up. They had no idea why there were five-hour lines, and nobody knew that the county had cut 70% of polling places until it had happened. I cover voting rights for a living, and I didn't know about this till 10 p.m. on election night in Arizona. And so these kind of things can make a very big difference. And I'm very concerned that on election day 2016, people are going to show up and their polling places have been cut or they've been changed, and it's going to be very hard for anyone to do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris.
Hello. How you doing?
Great.
I live here in San Francisco, a former felon, and glad that I'm able to vote in this state. But I have this question. Isn't it taxation without representation to take someone's money after they've gotten off parole and prohibit them from voting?
Chris, thanks.
That's a very good question from Chris. So the Supreme Court has upheld these kind of felon disenfranchisement laws under the 14th Amendment. But I think there's a hope that if there is a different Supreme Court, if there were, for example, a 5-4 liberal majority on the Supreme Court, they would reconsider things like felon disenfranchisement laws as either violating the 14th or the 15th Amendment to the Constitution because these laws are discriminatory. And it also just doesn't make sense. If the state has agreed that you have served your time, that you have paid your debt to society, why haven't you gotten one of the most fundamental rights in society, the right to vote, back? And there is actually evidence that former offenders who get their voting rights back are less likely to commit another crime. Now, there's obviously lots of reasons why someone would commit another crime, but I think there's some logic to the fact that if you're being treated as a productive member of society when you're released, you're more likely to want to go down that path as opposed to another path.
Chris, thanks for the call. John in Napa. Hi, John.
Good morning. I wanted to zero in on the documentation of the voter fraud, the Shibboleth, and ask Ari to recite again that national study which showed that only 31 out of so many votes, the instances of voter fraud, and do the Republicans, et cetera, cite any countervailing evidence. So if you could just repeat that citation, please.
Sure. So the study was done by Justin Levitt, who at the time was a professor at Loyola University in L.A. and is now the head of the voting section at the Justice Department, a civil rights division. It was published in the Washington Post. And what he found was that there were, from 2000 to 2014, there were only 31 credible cases of voter impersonation out of a billion votes cast. And no one has disproved his study. And I think what we see is that there are lots of overheated rhetoric about voting rights. Like, you hear people in Wisconsin saying, well, all of these people were bused from Chicago on election day to vote in Wisconsin. Or people in Minnesota will say, all these Somali refugees were illegally voting in Minnesota. But then you look at the evidence and you say, these things never happened. So it's kind of like those chain emails that went around saying that Barack Obama wasn't born in the United States and that people like Donald Trump amplified for so many years. You take a lie and then you say it enough times and people start to believe it, even if the evidence is overwhelmingly the opposite. And I think that's unfortunately what's happened with a lot of their rhetoric about voter fraud.
I want to thank John for the question and also, Ari, get you to respond to some pushback from the Heritage Foundation, where they say, quote, as long as elections put people into positions where they can make decisions about how much the government will spend, who will receive benefits, and how the government will exercise its power, some individuals will attempt to steal them. Examples abound, from the 135% of the eligible voters who turned out for an 1844 election in New York to the infamous ballot box 13 in Lyndon Johnson's 1948 Senate election, the 1997 Miami mayor's race was overturned because of more than 5,000 fraudulent absentee ballots, a mayoral election in East Chicago, Indiana in 2003, and a state Senate race in Tennessee in 2005 were also overturned because of voter fraud. They also cite that in 2013, four individuals in Indiana were convicted of forging signatures on the ballot petitions that qualified President Obama for the state's May 2008 primary. Do you want to respond to all that?
Sure. Well, I mean, there's a lot to respond to. What I'll say initially is that a lot of these examples are very old. So no one's arguing that there wasn't any voter fraud in Tammany Hall in New York in the 1800s or when Lyndon Johnson first ran for Senate. But that was a long time ago. And the cases of voter fraud that exist today, they're quite rare. And the fact is, when they happen, people are caught, like in the Miami mayoral election, because if the fraud is done in large enough numbers to swing an election, people are going to find out about the conspiracy. And they're often done, like in Miami, through absentee ballots, which voter ID laws aren't even addressing in most cases. So the idea that people are showing up and are voting multiple times, which is the type of thing that Donald Trump is saying is happening, the type of thing that Republicans have passed voter ID laws to try to stop, that's incredibly rare because that's, quite frankly, just a really stupid way to try to steal an election. If you show up multiple times impersonating another voter, it's very hard to pull off. And if you do it one or two times, you're probably going to get caught and then you're only going to swing one or two extra votes. So voter fraud occurs, but it's a very small problem in American elections and it's been blown totally out of proportion in recent years.
Well, let's go now to Scott in Bakersfield. Hi, Scott.
Hi. So my question for your guest is, it sounds like, and what I'm getting is that he wants to encourage those who have a right to vote to vote. And so, but my question is that if you want only those who do have a right to vote, legally, to vote, why push back against identifying who those people are? Why not make focus your movement on getting those people the proper identification so that they're able to produce that identification? Because there's always a way to get identification, even if you don't have the birth certificate or you don't have, a car to drive, for a driver's license. There's always that way to get that identification. Why not be more thorough and get people the identification they need so that when they do go to the voting booth, there is no question that they have the right to vote?
Scott, thanks. Ari?
So I'm not opposed to requiring identification to vote. I'm opposed to requiring identification that people don't have and that is burdensome to get. And let's just take Texas as an example. So the first thing is that in Texas, we know that 600,000 registered voters didn't have strict forms of ID. So people were being kept from the polls. Secondly, to be able to get the quote-unquote free ID, you needed underlying documentation like a birth certificate, which either people didn't have or cost money to try to get, which is why the district court initially called this a poll tax. Then you have to drill down a little bit deeper. Texas has 254 counties. In a third of the counties in Texas, there wasn't even a DMV office. So if you lived in rural Texas in one of these counties with no DMV office and you didn't drive, how are you supposed to get the free government-issued ID that's issued at the DMV? And so you were caught in this very difficult situation. And before Texas had this strict voter ID law, they required you to vote with some kind of ID, whether it was a voter registration card or something like that. And there was no epidemic of voter fraud that then meant that they had to somehow tighten the restriction. So I think that we can verify who people are through less restrictive means like voter registration cards, and that way we're not disenfranchising hundreds of thousands of people who don't have these IDs or in a state like Texas have a hard time, even if they want to, producing them.
Well, Phyllis writes, in Sweden, voters show ID when they vote. In Japan, voters show ID when they vote. In France, voters show ID when they vote. All over the world, voters show ID when they vote. But your guest thinks blacks can't come up with an ID.
Well, first off, I don't think that. That's something that the courts have documented extensively, that African Americans, Latinos, Asian Americans, other people of color are less likely to to have strict forms of government-issued ID. The difference in those countries is that those countries give you a national ID card when you're born. In Sweden and France and all of those places, you get an ID card, so everyone has them. The U.S. doesn't do this. So that's why there are disparities in terms of who has an ID. I think one possible compromise in this country would be for everyone to get an ID and everyone to then be automatically registered to vote, which is something that other countries do. California is going to begin doing this next year, which is that if you go to the DMV and you show that you're a citizen, you're going to be automatically registered as opposed to having to go through all the different steps to try to register. And so that's a possible compromise here, but we really can't point to other countries when they're doing things very differently. And in fact, they have far more progressive election laws than we do.
We're talking with Ari Berman, senior contributing writer to The Nation and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. We're also discussing how this November voters in more than a dozen states will see new voting restrictions. And I'd like to go now to Paul in Sunnyvale. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I'm calling about some YouTube videos that purportedly show how easy it is to commit voter fraud by registering fraudulently. In one case I saw, a young man was sent into a voter registration office with somebody taking a video camera, and he impersonated a local, I think he was a sports reporter, who was on a television or radio station or in a news in a newspaper column, and claimed to be this person. And they said, okay, may I see your ID to register you? He said, oh, I don't have my ID. It was stolen. And he says, okay, well, can you verify your address? And he gave an address, which he probably thought would work. And the clerk says, well, I have this person registered previously as voting at blah, 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 some other address. And he said, oh, yeah, that's I moved. So the clerk was obviously skeptical and wanted to talk to her supervisor. So she exited briefly and came back and says, okay, you can sign an affidavit and then you can register. And then the guy said, fine. So he signed the affidavit and was supposedly registered fraudulently. Now, what the clerk didn't say was that, you know, that if you sign an affidavit fraudulently, you're committing perjury. And if you go ahead and are convicted of perjury, or if you try to vote and are convicted of perjury, you can go to prison. Did you know that? Nothing was said about that. Apparently, the clerk didn't think of that or didn't know. And the guy walked out and said, see how easy it is to commit voter fraud?
So, Paul,
very interesting.
It sounds like those videos did not convince you then, the videos that were designed to convince people it's easy to commit voter fraud?
No, it seemed to me like convinced that clerk was poorly trained, and that her supervisor was ignorant or poorly trained. Because if she went to her supervisor and says, "I think this person is trying to pretend to be somebody else," her supervisor should have said, "Well, he can sign an affidavit saying that he is that person." But there are consequences if he is shown to be signing a false affidavit. He is committing perjury.
Well,
and he was never warned.
Yeah. Paul, thanks for the story. Ari, did you want to respond?
So I haven't seen the video. There's obviously a lot of things out there on YouTube. I don't have time to watch all of them. But I will make a general point that, yeah, I mean, you can try, if you're really committed to doing so, to impersonate a voter one or two times. But if you do so, you're likely to get caught. And if you get caught, you're likely to be hit with a felony, a fine, and jail time. And then you're only swinging one or two extra votes. And I think that's why voter impersonation is so rare, because the risks of doing it really don't translate to the rewards. Okay, you're going to go through all this effort. You're going to risk a prosecution. You're going to risk jail time. You're going to risk a fine. And then you're going to swing one extra vote at the end of the day. This is not an efficient way to try to steal an election. And so I think that there are people out there that could maybe try to pull this off in isolated cases, but it's far from an epidemic that is plaguing American politics.
Again, the number to call if you want to weigh in is 866-733-6786. Our email address is forum@kqed.org. Our website is kqed.org/forum, and you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Elaine in Oakland. Hi, Elaine.
Good morning. Could the guest speak about the practice of some states throwing people off of the voting roll because supposedly they voted in another state and, oh, I don't know, their name is George Johnson. Mm. There might be a late George Johnson from the country. I heard a little bit from Greg Palast about this, but I'm a little bit confused. I was in North Carolina in 2014 for Get Out the Vote. I know thousands of people were thrown off.
Elaine, thanks. Yeah, what about this practice? There's been some writing about this in terms of attempts to purge the rolls of people with the same name in another state.
Yeah, so every state purges the voting rolls, and sometimes it's done in a totally above the board manner, and sometimes people are wrongly purged, and it has major consequences. We've seen there was a Rolling Stone article about this, that people are being purged from voting in multiple states, even though they haven't voted in multiple states, they just share the same name. There was just a decision right before I came on air where Ohio's voter purge was just overturned, that Ohio was purging people who had voted infrequently. So let's say they voted in the 2008 election, but they hadn't voted in 2012, and they're getting purged from the rolls, even though you're not supposed to be purged from the rolls under the National Voter Registration Act for not voting during a certain period of time. So there's lots of different ways in which you can purge the voting rolls that are potentially problematic. This has had a big impact in past elections. I can give you one example from my book, which is during the 2000 election in Florida. They did a massive voter purge, and they claimed that all of these ex-felons were on the voting rolls and needed to be purged. And Florida was one of only a handful of states like Virginia that prevented ex-felons from voting. The problem was that, number one, the purge was inaccurate, that people were labeled as felons even if their last names and their middle names didn't match the names on the voter registration rolls. The second problem was that the purge was discriminatory, that African Americans in Florida, for example, were 11% of the electorate, but 44% of those on the voter purge list. So what happened is, on Election Day 2000, longtime voters showed up at the polls. They were wrongly told they were felons, and they were prevented from voting in Florida. After that very close 2000 election, the NAACP sued the state of Florida, and the state admitted that 12,000 registered voters were wrongly purged from the voting rolls because they were inaccurately labeled as felons. And that was 22 times George W. Bush's margin of victory in the state. So sometimes these things don't get any attention, but they can have a huge impact on the outcome of the election. So I think if we're going to purge the voting rolls, we have to be absolutely sure it's being done in an accurate way.
I'm sure many people remember that election. Sean in Palo Alto. Hi, Sean.
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Right. My quick question is that, I mean, all this is, thank you so much for raising awareness about these issues. Clearly, there is racial segregation going on at very high levels of elected office, public offices. What do we do about it? Because you don't hear President Obama say anything. You don't hear Hillary Clinton say as or nearly as much as Trump. So how would we deal with this? Thank you so much.
Sean, thanks. Yeah. I mean, what are some effective ways if you're concerned about what's happening, right? In terms of efforts to restrict voting, what are some effective ways to try to address it?
So one way is the laws are being challenged in the court. There's lots of different groups that are doing this, from the ACLU to the NAACP to the Brennan Center for Justice. The second thing is trying to help people comply with the laws that exist, so helping people get the right ID or make sure they know when to vote or how to register. The third thing is trying to pass better laws. There's legislation in Congress to restore the Voting Rights Act. It's called the Voting Rights Advancement Act. It has bipartisan support. The problem is that the Republican leadership won't move on it. And states could pass more progressive policies as well to try to expand the number of people that vote. California is doing many of these things right now. The fact that you have online registration, election day registration, the fact that California will have automatic registration, which will hopefully register hundreds of thousands of people. These are good steps. We know that when states take measures to make it easier to vote, more people do, in fact, participate. And so I think if, as a country, we had a commitment to getting more people to vote, we could actually make it happen. The problem is that in many states, people have the opposite priority, which is trying to get fewer people to vote and making it harder to vote instead.
Okay, but between now and the election, what about community organizations? What are the best strategies for them?
Yeah. So I would say, you know, talk to your local groups, talk to your local League of Women Voters, talk to the local ACLU chapter, talk to the local NAACP chapter, see what they need help with. Because I don't want to tell someone in Palo Alto to help people in North Carolina if there's an issue they can work on in Palo Alto. So I think the local groups need to know best. Right now, we're in a situation where registration deadlines close in most states. So I would say help register voters. In states that have strict ID laws, help as many people as possible try to get the right forms of ID. In states that have early voting, urge people to vote early so there aren't long lines on election day. And so I would look at all of that, but we're running out of time here. We're less than 50 days out of an election, so there's a sense of urgency to do all of this.
And we, too, need to go to a break. You're listening to Forum. We're talking to Ari Berman. He is the senior contributing writer to The Nation and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Mina Kim. Ari Berman, have you found that, some of the emphasis on or some of these attempts to restrict voting or restrict voter fraud, that they're actually having the effect where they're mobilizing more people to get involved this election?
We saw some evidence of this in 2012, that efforts to make it harder to vote actually made people more committed to being able to vote. And we saw black turnout, for example, in states like Ohio increase in 2012 to 2008. It's interesting. If you look at from 2012 to 2008, voter turnout declined among every demographic group except African Americans 55 and older. And what I took from that and what I took from my interviews was that people who grew up during Jim Crow, who understood the time when there was poll taxes and literacy tests, they were most committed to making sure that they weren't disenfranchised again. So I think in some cases, this can have a backlash effect. But I think the question we should be asking is, why are we making it more difficult to vote in the first place? That in this country, even in our best years, only 60% of eligible voters turn out. Shouldn't we be trying to get that number higher, get more people to vote, as opposed to continually figuring out ways to exclude people from the political process?
Kevin writes, I recently was talking with a friend from India who said that in his country, they're dumbfounded that in the USA, the bastion of democracy, voting is run locally and voting laws differ from state to state. As the world's largest democracy, India has a very strong and independent elections commission in which the government can't interfere. The commission oversees all elections at all levels and ensures that all voting methods and laws are consistent across the country. Indians feel strongly that without such protection for the voter, no election results can be trusted. And April writes, my husband is currently volunteering in Florida for Hillary Clinton, and the voter registration team there said that many poor voters won't vote by mail because they can't afford the stamp. That actually was something that I read in an article related to folks in Georgia who were seeing cutbacks in polling places and saying that they simply weren't going to vote as a result just because they really didn't have the means to vote by mail. Honest.
So two different things. I mean, one is I think we have a lot to learn from how the rest of the world runs elections. Elections here are run so complicated. We don't just have elections where laws vary state to state, laws vary county to county, and sometimes precinct to precinct. So the fact that we are the country that's exporting democracy all across the world and we have so many problems with democracy at home is disturbing. The second thing is that in states like Oregon that do vote by mail, they pay the postage for every voter to be able to mail a ballot. And you'd like to see that states would take on that responsibility, that we would decide that making as many people as possible would be a top priority, and that the state would invest resources in that as opposed to cutting polling places or doing other things that make it harder for people to vote under the guise of saving money. So I really think that I wish we had a national consensus that said that we should be making it easier to vote, that ensuring that everyone can vote is a top national priority, and our laws and our priorities and our funding would reflect that.
Well, we just have a couple minutes left. I think I can squeeze in one more call from Beth in San Francisco. Hi, Beth.
Hi. My sister lives in Tucson, Arizona. About a month ago, she received a letter in English only stating that if she did not affirm that she still lived at the address where she had lived for the past few years, she would be taken off the rolls. Hmm. And she had not received anything prior to this. It had a deadline attached to it. And she was shocked because there's a large Spanish-speaking community in Tucson, and she didn't realize that once she was registered, she was having to tell them again, hey, I'm still here and I'm going to vote.
Well, Beth, thanks. Are you a quick response from you?
It sounds like a big problem. It sounds like a big problem that she got that letter out of nowhere, that in many cases she might just not open it, and that in a state like Arizona with a large number of Spanish-speaking people, that this was only in English. So these are the kind of under-the-radar things that occur in elections that can have a big impact on the outcome.
Well, Ari Berman, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ari Berman is senior contributing writer to The Nation and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. He talks about how 2016 is the first presidential election in 50 years when citizens won't have the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. We have sources on our website, kqed.org/forum, on the states with new voting restrictions. We encourage you to take a look at that. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, with support today from Jim Bennett. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font, and help today with engagement from Jeremy Siegel. Our interns are Maxine Schofer-Wolf and Brandon Yu. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Mina Kim. Thank you for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.